in your marketing, authority is the priority. To me, two of the key ways that I've found for myself, as well as the clients that I work with, financial advisors, in terms of how they can position themselves, but ultimately attract their ideal clients and influence people and really create what I described jokingly as that pretty girl effect where people are coming to them, comes down to speaking and authorship.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Paul McManus, welcome to Bridging the Gap, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be fun, man. We were talking, you know, pre-recording, and, you know, I'm a huge fan of what you're doing and what we're going to talk about here all around writing books, the power of books, because, you know, I've been through the journey of writing a couple myself, and I just am a fan of it. I think that there's so much opportunity in it. I think that the challenge is sometimes people think it's too burdensome, but it can be simpler.
Yeah.
So I'm really stoked about this, man. And we're going to have a good time and a fun conversation. And I'm just super appreciative of you joining us and spending time with us here on the pod. So before I get into all the fun stuff and the actionable tactical stuff that will help people make money and grow their prospect pipeline and client pipeline, et cetera, I've got to ask, what did the 13-year-old Paul McManus want to be when he grew up?
Great question. So I've been thinking about this because I was watching a few of your other podcasts and I was expecting this question to come. And I don't know if I was exactly 13 or maybe a couple years within that, but when I thought about it, I used to want to be J.R. Ewing. Now, I don't know how old you are, but back when I was a kid, there was a TV show called Dallas, which was all about Texas oil fields and was all about becoming spectacularly rich and whatnot. And for some reason, I was really attracted to that. So I guess at that point, I wanted to become really, really rich. Now, I have to add to this, my whole life, I've thought that that was my purpose, to make a lot of money. And somewhat recently, I've done very well for myself. And I got to a point where money was no longer a motivator. And I thought, and it was almost like an identity crisis. It's like, wait a minute, I'm all about the money. I want to make money. And to find out that I'm not motivated by money anymore was really kind of a letdown. I told my family, they were all disappointed in me. Just joking.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you say you wanted to be from that show Dallas. You know, I always, you know, I love that question. And I ask it to everybody because I just think it provides some perspective and a connection as well. Because now I'm doing the pod and doing some video stuff and everything. And I was always inspired when I was younger. I wanted to be Stuart Scott on ESPN on SportsCenter. I just thought that it was like so engaging, and like the idea of how you like bring entertainment to people. I thought they did such a great job on SportsCenter. And so, yeah, that's funny. Don't be sad. I let my family down with a lot of things as well. My dreams and ambitions. And, you know, I told my son the other day that he's got to stop getting stuff from the store every time we go. And because money is precious. And so that was a big letdown for him.
It leads into an interesting topic, because even though I found that simply making money isn't my primary motivator, I still am ambitious and I still want to get to the next level in my career, whatever that looks like. And one of my clients, he's super successful. Just to give you a sense of it, he does roughly $10 billion of AUM, and we're helping him write a couple books right now. And so it's interesting because we're on these weekly Zoom calls, and I'm there helping him, you know, facilitate the process to get him to talk out his ideas and share his stories. And honestly, at the same time, I'm just taking notes. I'm like, okay, wait, no, what'd you do there? And the concept, and by the way, do you know a person named Dan Sullivan? So the concept that I realized what I need to think about to get to the next level, and Dan Sullivan talks about this a lot, and then my client was talking about this as well, and it comes down to the idea of needs versus wants. And so if you look at your income just from a needs perspective, you say, hey, I pretty much have what I want. I'm not trying to get the extra car, the bigger house, the whatever. And that's where I'm at. I'm just pretty much content. Then your motivation starts to wane. And so the secret that I'm discovering from both my client as well as Dan Sullivan is that really it's about wants. And you need to make your wants your needs. And that becomes more interesting because now it's not just, okay, a dollar amount. It's, you know, what is that experience or what is that lifestyle or, you know, what have you, and how can I imagine that and do more of that? And so now it's becoming a little bit more fun to think about it in those terms.
Yeah, that's super interesting. My my business partner has written a couple books on and done some deep studies on happiness and what we focus on retirees at our firm and what makes a happy retiree. And there is a plateau effect that happens in terms of income and also savings, that ultimately when you reach a certain level, there's the diminishing marginal returns of an incremental more dollar of savings or an incremental dollar of income. And it's a matter of having core pursuits, being close to family, being connected religiously, all that type of stuff. And, you know, the interesting thing is also on that equation that you talk about, you know, there's also another way of thinking about it, is that it's a matter of focusing and having really focused and actionable wants, because it's actually a happiness equation of have versus wants. Have over wants is the equation, with wants being the denominator. And your happiness is when your haves are more than your wants, you actually become happier. Because if you get that wants where you want a new car, or you want a bigger home, or you want and you're striving to keep up with the Joneses, then your equation as a formula, right, your haves become less and you now have a lower than sub one optimal level of happiness. And so you got to be careful. But if you can have them be actionable and they become goal-oriented, right, that you then can strive for, then now you have this kind of, but your mentality is like, I want to switch this into a need that I have, that I need to have, not that I want. And if you limit those, then you reshape the equation. I think that's a really super interesting aspect of happiness.
Yeah. Very cool.
That's great. And so I'm curious, you know, and before we dive into books in general, and I mean, like these types of things that you learn from all of these successful individuals that have been in the business, I'm sure you have stories for days, which we'll get into. How did you go from the Dallas days of 13 to now helping wealth managers write books?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, probably for many of us, it wasn't a straight path, right? I'll jump in where it's probably most relevant for our listeners. And in 2015, I started my online marketing agency. In 2016, I met my very first financial advisor client. His name was Shane Walls, and he was from Texas. And I happened to be living there at the time, and he approached me. And he was already very successful at the time. And by that, I mean he was doing a couple $100,000 of commission per year. He did that consistently, so I would describe that as successful. But he was ambitious, right? So he had that want to become a million-dollar producer. And the short version of this is that over the next 2.5 years, I helped him go from essentially a couple $100,000 of commission up to $2.5 million of commission. And he graciously, so obviously he's excited, his producer group's excited, the life insurance carriers he worked with were thrilled, and they're asking him, so, what's your secret? What'd you do? You know, how'd you make this transformation? Because I think those transformations are somewhat rare. You know, as much as we love the rags to rich stories, you know, they are unique. And so he pointed in my direction, and they started inviting me to speak at their conferences. And so fast forward to 2018, and I was in Orange County in California, and I was speaking at the FFR, it's a elite life insurance group. To give you a sense of it, people need to make a certain production, but also pay $25,000 a year simply to belong to the group. And so, you know, these are for, you know, serious people. And I had two breakout sessions, and it ended up being standing only, not because I'm special, but because they knew the story of Shane. And there are, you know, the members were all interested to find out, okay, well, how did he do this? And so I just treated the whole thing really as an interview with him. Again, I know that I didn't have by myself credibility. He had credibility, and it was really what I call authority by association. And so from that experience, by the end of it, I got a stack of people applying to work with me at the end of the event, many, many new customers. And at the time, I was charging this really ridiculous high price for my services. And so I needed to have that authority and all those things going in to really be able to effectively sell what I was doing. But that was my first time to experience what I call either authority positioning or authority marketing. And I'll use an analogy that I oftentimes use. So we're both guys. I'm happily married. I assume
I'm happily married
yes. as well. But you know,
minus the two kids. I'm just kidding.
Back in the day, you know, the analogy I use is the pretty girl at the bar. And you know, if you've ever been to a bar when you're single and there's like a pretty girl there and there's a bunch of guys, you know, she knows what kind of power she has, right? She could say, okay, I want a drink from you, a drink from you. You gotta, you know, stand on one foot, you know, turn around, whatever it is. She has the power. And so for a fleeting moment, I felt like the pretty girl at the bar. And it was such an important lesson in what I call authority positioning that since that moment, everything I've been about, both for myself as well as the way that I help my clients, is about how do we position them as authorities so that they have that massive credibility, that massive influence, and then how do we take that and use it for everything they do, for their marketing, for their sales, and just, you know, everything they do, and really flip the script, I'd call it. So instead of them chasing clients and being seen as that person that is always, you know, that salesperson, how do you flip that and make them the educator and have the clients come to them? And I know that was a long story, so I'm going to pause there and give it back to you.
There's so much there. And you also reminded me of how lucky I was to win over my wife, because she was that pretty one and I just got dumb. I was dumb luck on my part, because I usually don't talk to those. I don't talk to many people. But there's so much that we can dive into on the authority side that I want to get into. And I want to kind of dive this. I want to kind of travel a journey with books, because I think that there is, you know, I'm fortunate to talk with a lot of advisors. I've been fortunate to be really friendly with a good number of them, and a lot of successful advisors, but even, you know, the successful ones and the ones that may be struggling right now, they all have the same challenge in mind, which is organic growth. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a recent paper called Welcome to the Jungle that Mark Hurley wrote, that's talking about how organic growth is the key, but everybody's focused on inorganic growth, which is just acquisitions. And when I look at books, as an avenue, not necessarily the avenue, the only avenue, but a avenue of like a multi-avenue approach or a multi-pronged approach. And so I want to go down a journey of understanding the value. And then I want to talk about writing, and I want to talk about how to be heard in this noisy world that we're in. And so let's start with the value of books. You know, if you had to boil down the value of a book into a simple statement that people could remember and then repeat again and again to others, what would that statement be? What would you say to someone that would make them, and you kind of alluded to it with authority here, but what would that be? What is the value of writing a book?
Sure. I'll give it to you in one statement, and then with your permission, I'll expand upon it. But the
no, very strict here on this podcast. We don't go down rabbit holes.
One statement to take away is, in your marketing, authority is the priority. And if you take that concept and you apply it not just to your marketing, but to your positioning, to your sales conversations, potentially to how you attract, if you're doing acquisitions, how do you do that? But just really a 360 in who you are and how people perceive you, authority is the priority. And so then the follow-up to that is, well, why books? And in my experience, and I'd love to get your perspective on this because I think you can relate, to me, two of the key ways that I've found for myself as well as the clients that I work with, financial advisors, in terms of how they can position themselves, but ultimately attract their ideal clients and influence people and really create what I described jokingly as that pretty girl effect, where people are coming to them, comes down to speaking and authorship. And so speaking, for example, this is an example of speaking. So a lot of us now are familiar with the idea of podcasts. You can be a host on a podcast. You can be a guest on a podcast, which is what I'm currently doing. You can speak in person at events. I think probably speaking in person at events to the right audience is probably still the pinnacle of what you want to do. Although for many of us, those opportunities are a little bit harder to come by, right? So like next month, I'm going to be speaking at an event in San Diego, which is going to be great. But this is an annual event, so I have to wait a year to do this. And so speaking, I have my own podcast, but I do a lot of guest podcasting like we're doing now. Now, if you combine that with a book, there's a huge synergy there. And it's because ultimately it's the positioning that the book gives you. I think there's a lot of respect that our culture gives to authors. I think many people, especially successful people, ambitious people, have thought about writing a book, and it might be on their bucket list to do one day. But when they envision it, they imagine having to write this 50,000 word War and Peace novel that they're going to have to take a sabbatical on. And oftentimes you ask them, so what stops you from writing a book? It's like, well, I don't have any time. And I think the reality is there's a couple other things going on there. There's clarity. It's like, how do I actually do this? What are the next steps? I think there's another interesting one, which is imposter syndrome. And who am I to write a book? And you know, I always find that really interesting because I'm sure like you, I've talked to many people that are very successful, and yet they still suffer from imposter syndrome at times. I know that I do at times. And so I know I'm going a little windy thing here, but at the end of the day, what I've come up with for myself in terms of a service and how I work with advisors primarily is that before we do anything else, before we, you know, do Facebook or LinkedIn or all these other things, you want to get the foundation correct. And I find that the book is one of the best ways to establish that foundation in a very powerful way. And just the process of writing it, and we help people do it in about 6 to 12 weeks, which we can talk about later, it gets them a lot of clarity in their message, who they are. They get in touch with all the value that they bring, the stories, et cetera. And then you have that as a foundation, and now you're prepared to go out and do all these things, and you get an exponential return on investment, right? So if you're speaking, your results are better because now you're an author. Maybe you have a book. If you're doing podcasts, your results are better. Maybe you can get on better shows. I use the book as my hook, right? It's like, I don't say, hey, I'm anything special. I say, I'm the author of this book. You know, can I be on your show? But I'll pause there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you said that. You know, I think that, and I want to get into that in regards to writing the book, because not enough time. I think there's also this lack of like, what do I write about? I'm boring. But the imposter syndrome thing is really a real thing. I mean, that's something that I deal with every day. I mean, every time I do this podcast, I'm talking to people that are much smarter than me, and I'm just waiting to be exposed of how, you know, silly and stupid I really am. And so I've got to be, you know, it's a lot of work, right, to overcome that. But like, that's a real thing that sometimes we don't want to put ourselves out there in something like a book because we're fearful that we're going to be exposed to the world because we're going to say something that's going to be perceived as being bad, which then is going to expose us as being not in the right job and not as knowledgeable as we need to be. And in reality, you know, I had to deal with that with each one of my books. And you can go read some of my books, and the newer ones are much better than the first one, but they're all part of the journey that have got me to where I am. And I've accepted that. And I think that that is also, you know, when you say authority is the priority, that's something super interesting as a perspective. Because that is the thing about books, is that it does bring like this like perceived authority, like that you know what you're talking about because you took the time and the effort to write a book. Like authors have this. But what is the ROI? How do you judge the ROI for an author? What should the expectation be? Because I think that a lot of authors come into it, first-time authors, and they think that they can become the John Grishams of the world and become a New York Times bestseller, and they're going to make all this money off of selling a book. Whereas that's not, I mean, I still get like royalties, but I think I just got one yesterday for, I think, about like 3 pennies. And so I told my kids, like I said, you can't buy things because we're not selling enough books. But what should the ROI be, and how do you judge success of a book in that mindset?
So the first thing in terms of the way that we approach this is that we tell them it's not about writing a book to sell. It's about writing a book that sells you. And so the whole royalty thing, typically we'll ultimately in most cases help people simply publish to Amazon, and strategically we'll mark it down to the bottom price, because oftentimes it's the author when they're engaging with prospects and clients are saying, hey, can I send you a copy of my book? I mean, I do this all the time and I don't want to charge myself more. So I can literally price my book at $4 on Amazon, and with Prime, I can send it to someone for free. In a couple of days, it's printed on demand. And so during sales conversations, for example, I'll give you a concrete example of the ROI and the organic way to do this. So this is one way. Whenever I talk to a new prospect, the process is typically that they'll schedule a 15-minute appointment on my calendar. And at this point, I don't know who they are typically. They've heard me on a podcast or something like that. And then if that conversation goes well and we both feel that there's a potential stage here, I'll say, great, let's now have a meeting for maybe next week for an hour. We'll meet on Zoom, etc. But here's the twist is that I'm going to send you a copy of my book. It takes only about 60 to 90 minutes to read it. Is that something that you're willing to do before our next meeting? And in 80, 90% of the case, I get a yes. And for the 10% that say no, I pause and say, well, you know, essentially, I don't schedule the next meeting because I find that I want people that are committed to the process. And so it's an enormous time saver. It really weeds out what we describe as the tire kickers, because they're making that commitment. And the books that we help people write, my book included, is strategically done where a person can reasonably read it in about 60 to 90 minutes. So now guess what happens? They've already made the commitment to read your book. When they show up in the next meeting, they already know all about you from reading the book. I mean, I call this the your salesperson in print. It's meant to be educational, but it's also meant to position yourself in such a way, your stories, your value proposition, what differentiates you, some of the exciting things that you help clients do. So by the time they come to that next meeting, they already know enough to make a buying decision. And so typically, myself included and the clients I work with, they're able to take a complete stranger from, you know, 2 weeks ago or a month ago, and within that process of two calls, get them to say yes to their services. And so if you think about organic ROI and just take that one use case, think about, you know, what is your sales cycle like? How many calls does it typically take? Because that's the one thing that I hear, and then I'll flip it back to you, is that for someone struggling or even not struggling, the first thing is how do I get enough qualified leads in my pipeline? That's always problem number one. But problem number two is, well, I had these great calls, but they're ghosting me. And so how do you go, especially in this online world, how do you get people to commit to the process and take the next step without it taking 3, 6, 12 months?
Yeah, I find that as like a really unique idea, how you leverage it. I never thought about it that way, but the way of being able to take a book and say, read this for, you know, and wealth managers could do this all the time, right? It's like, hey, I've got a book. We had our first call, 30-minute check-in call. I'm going to send you this book, and it could be more of like a workbook or be your process and your story, and it could be, you know, 60 to 80 pages. That's fine. And be like, hey, read this book as part of your process. And maybe within the book, you have like a link to do a survey or something of that nature. And they do it and it's like engaging as opposed to just having like a pre-meeting questionnaire.
Yeah.
And someone can, and that can be part of the process. And they say no, then, you know, likely that person's not worth, you're going to be wasting a lot of time to try to convince them. But when they say yes, it's going to be such a more warm and fulfilling and in-depth, deep conversation that's likely going to get more of a yes sooner from that standpoint, which is just like a way of changing your onboarding process.
Exactly right. And sometimes you get someone that maybe is qualified, but just the timing's not right for them. And so in that case, oftentimes, if I still feel that there's a potential there, I'll still send them a copy of my book, because the unique thing about a book versus, say, a brochure or a business card or all these other tools is that a book tends to be kept, right? Whether or not the person reads it, people tend not to throw books away. It goes on the bookshelf, and then say 3, 6, 9 months pass. And now that problem or that desire that they were facing starts to become a little bit more important to them. Chances are they get the book. They know what the next step is because you say, hey, before we schedule the next call, read my book. They read the book, they show up. And so it's amazing. You know, we all love those quick turnarounds and someone immediately takes action, they sign up, et cetera. But you also have to have a long-term view as well and a strategy. And so how do you plan to engage people over a longer period of time so that when the timing is right, and ultimately it's all about timing, that you become that go-to choice for them.
And that kind of brings me to another area that I'm interested in is when you think about writing a book, we'll get into kind of creating the content and writing the book, but the process of like, of getting the value after the book, right? What is the commitment to realizing the full potential of a book, right? I always think about, you know, the guys like Tim Ferriss, Gary Vaynerchuk, like Dave Ramsey, like they became known when they wrote a book. Now they did it in another way, but they wrote a book They marketed the heck out of it.
Nope.
They created a brand around it.
Nope.
And that's who they were.
No.
That seems like a huge, heavy commitment to many people. But and that was them selling themselves. Yes, they were looking to sell books as well,
mm-hmm.
but they were mainly selling themselves. And so is the commitment just, hey, I got 6 to 12 weeks and I've got a book written and that's good. And now all I just got to do is remember to just give it out to people or promote it. Or is there this commitment to get the full value and potential of the book of, I need to invest now going forward into marketing mm-hmm. and writing content continuously and becoming a thought leader and letting the book be the foundation to build bigger off of. And it may not be one or the other, but I'm curious what you see mm-hmm. from a success standpoint of the commitment beyond just the writing of the
yeah.
book.
I think there's a couple ways to think about it. It ultimately comes back to the person's goals. So I'll give you a couple different examples. In one case, the person's name is Jesse. We helped him write a book, and he already has a thriving wealth management practice. He has lots of clients. And so his purpose behind writing his book was fairly narrowly conceived, which is one, he wanted to position himself more as an authority. Two, he wanted something that he could give to his clients, as well as he does seminars. And so when he does the seminars already, he's bringing the book in just to try to improve the conversion and the ROI. Third, I think having a book, especially when you have a nice client base, becomes one of the easiest ways to get referrals. And I'll explain that. So assuming that you do good work, many of your clients want to refer you. And the question is, well, why don't I get more referrals? And in my mind, I think it's because nobody wants to assume that their friend has a problem, right? Oh, she's struggling with her finances. She needs your help, right? And so there's a level of discomfort there. But when, say, your financial advisor is an author, and it's a much more seamless way to say, hey, I just wrote a book and I'd love to give you a copy and I'll give you an extra copy. And is there anyone, in your life that, we're on a mission to help, however you frame it, American families, do better, et cetera. Is there anyone in your life that you think would benefit from me sending them a complimentary copy of my book? So what just happened there? That's a much easier introduction, first of all. And secondly, depending on specifically what you do, sometimes there's different perceptions about a financial advisor, or maybe it's like a life insurance agent, et cetera. But now you're not that, you're an author, you're an expert, you're a teacher. And so, and the person might be excited. It's like, yeah, my financial advisor, he's an author, he's a celebrity. And there's degrees of that, obviously. But it's just really, from an organic standpoint, it can significantly impact your referrals. I've seen some research that says that you can get up to 3 times as many referrals when you introduce a book as part of the process. And so, again, starting with, I don't want to be the next Tim Ferriss necessarily, or the next Dave Ramsey, Suze Orman, name your person. I just want a tool that's going to give me an immediate and long-term return on investment, and that I can build into what I'm currently doing. That's the other part of it I'll just add, is that a book is unique in the sense that it's very different from, say, doing Facebook ads or these different things that are more advertising, where, from day one to day 30, you spend so much money and you have a specific result. Either I got this many leads, you got this many clients, or I didn't. A book has the potential to give you an immediate ROI through some of the ways that I described, but it can also give you a long-term ROI, because assuming the content is still relevant 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years potentially later, it's still doing the work for you.
Mm. Yeah, it's got to be evergreen. It's super interesting. I think one thing that I learned as you're talking from my books is I had a clear goal, but not a clear enough goal.
Mm.
And there's something to be said about writing what you want to write about and then writing what people care about. And that also can help your mission, right? So like I wrote about really what I wanted to and hoped that it would create people that they would find value in it. But in reality, it may have been a misalignment, because I was erring more on what I wanted to write about, what was interesting to me, not what was necessarily interesting to promoting what I needed from that book. And I think that you have to have that right mentality when you go into the book of saying, what you do every day may seem redundant and repetitive to you, but it's super interesting to others. And if you can take that and distill it down into something that's engaging, people are going to find it interesting, and it can be a tool to leverage what you do every day mm-hmm. to now create a marketing engine that can help you grow into the future as well from that standpoint.
I would add to what you said. So I agree with that. And the way that we would work with a client, and we would distinguish this when we first started talking, because we want to make sure that we're helping people get that ROI, because then they become our raving fans and our biggest advocates. And so just to repeat what you said a little bit, if you write a book based on what you want to write versus writing a book to position yourself better with a specific market, those are two different books. I think they both have value, but the first one may or may not have an ROI, right? It's more of a passion project. I want to write about this because I'm passionate about it. And it, again, it has its place. The books that we're more focused on is the other version, which is we start with, who's this book for, right? And so with a lot of financial advisors, oftentimes I come across, you know, the typical financial advisor, in my experience, generally doesn't have a well-defined market other than maybe, hey, pre-retirees, as an example. And so, but if you look at, say, business owners versus professionals, or maybe some industry versus some other industry, doctors, nurses, IT professionals, what have you, however you decide to define your market, you want to get that clarity, because whether you're swimming in this market today, part of becoming that bigger fish, especially through a book, is to say not just where I'm at today, but where do I want to be in 5 years? And what's the path to get there? So just as an example, if I wanted to be the go-to person nationally for, let's say, nurses to come to me for financial planning, and maybe I have a few nurses today that I work with, and part of my thinking is that I love working with them, I want to work with more of them, that starts the process of the book. So we have a clear objective. Okay, how do I build my authority within this niche community? And so the book starts from the perspective of, what do nurses care about? What are their fears, desires? What keeps them up at night? What's the language that they use? And I have an interesting example there. So I was working with a client, his name's Michael, and he works with nurses, and kind of just what I described there. This is maybe a year or two back. And the first potential title we came up with for the book was Smart Nurses Finish Rich. And I think we found that pattern somewhere, and we're like, oh, that's kind of a cool pattern. We kind of iterated on it. And then I asked him, say, hey, so you have some nurse clients, go and do what I call insights interviews. In other words, simply schedule a call, ask them open-ended questions, get in their own words and their language what their, you know, their fears, desires, et cetera, what keeps them up at night. And he did that as a, you know, he was awesome. He did that. He came back, did like 3 or 4 of those. And not one of them said that they want to get rich. That was not their language. And so we immediately knew that that was the wrong framing for the book. And so we ended up changing it to The Prosperous Nurse. And it was more about prosperity, a little bit more holistically, and how you can do that. But it really starts in knowing what the target is, who's your audience, who's your reader, who's your ideal prospect, and then working your way backwards. What are their concerns? What's the conversation going on in their head? And then writing the book to that. And then in my mind, or in my experience, that's how you can create that asset for your business that has that can have immediate ROI. You can have long-term ROI, but it starts to position you more as authority for a market. And these things are all relative, right? So I think the wrong framing is like, hey, I want to be Tim Ferriss, you know, next month or next year. I want to be Dave Ramsey next year. That could be an aspirational goal, and I'm not going to, you know, go for it. But to me, really, the starting point is that if a prospect is looking for a financial advisor, typically they're comparing you to maybe one or two other people. What's the tool that's going to differentiate between you and those two other people? Well, chances are those two other people don't have a book. And so if they're able to engage with your book before they really engage with you and get a sense of who you are, they say, wow, our values align and that's exactly what I want, you're going to be the one that they choose.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's super interesting. And I think that the idea of talking and understanding your market of who you're trying to position this book for is super important. I just finished this morning writing a blog for an email coming out soon. And if you haven't signed up, it's The Circle. Go sign up for The Circle. A quick plug for me.
I signed up today. I am thrilled. I got my confirmation email and I'm waiting for the next step.
Well, you got the next one that's coming out. It is something all around that, where it's a lesson that I learned with building our technology business, where, you know, just because you're in the business, like, and I'm preaching this to wealth managers because it's something I learned the hard way. We lost $7 million building a business that failed. And there's a lot of lessons learned. And one of those lessons is that we had overconfidence bias that was driven because we knew the industry. And it then led to us kind of doing some, like, we tried to scale too fast. We just got in this idea. But one of the things is that the thing that we failed on is that we got confirmation that this technology was already being used by other people in other businesses. And then we thought, because we were in the business for so long, we had built two wealth management firms that were super successful, that we knew all of it, that we could just, we already had the confirmation, we had the confidence, and we went in and we just dove right into it. And we went and built the full suite of the product, as opposed to starting small and getting our own market research and our own confirmation and getting true product market fit, as they call it in the techie world. And we failed, because what we delivered was what we thought people wanted, because we thought we knew them so much, because we've been in the business serving thousands of families.
No.
And we were wrong. And so I say, I challenge, as you go and write a book, do that work, right? That market research, do it in a small approach. Take this title, say, how does this sit with you? No. Here's this theme of a book. Here, what are you thinking? What do you care about? And use that, because that's like really simple stuff that's low cost and low time, and won't lead you to lose a lot of money. And it's the same thing with building a business, that wealth managers, we get so overconfident. We know our clients so well because it's a relationship business, that we don't need to talk to them about this new idea we have or this new service or this new marketing initiative. Mm-hmm. But in reality, that's the first part, or we're going to miss out on so much, and we're going to do something that just falls flat in that point.
Yeah. I find that the book and just many applications, it just the process of it. I mean, we try to keep it fairly streamlined. So we help people typically in 6 to 12 weeks. And sometimes they take longer because they want to do some stuff, and we're okay with that. But ultimately, it's just a great opportunity to really do some of that market research, right? So it's like, hey, I have an idea for writing a book. And again, I'll use the nurse example towards nurses. And then you start looking at your list of nurses and talk to them, you do insights interviews, you hear their language, what they say, so that it can help inform what you write about. Another example, we're working with someone, and he has a big community of financial advisors and CPAs. And so one of the final steps before we publish it is that we go out, we have a service that's available online called 99 Designs, and we get a bunch of different book cover options. But it's kind of fun, because then we get, you know, 10, 20 different options. And then he's now sending it out to his community and saying, hey, which option do you like? And so you're just really engaging the community, and you get, you know, people can rate them and score them, and you get all kinds of feedback that before you ever launch, hopefully you've gotten more clarity in terms of what the market wants and what they're going to be responsive to, so that by the time you do publish, now you have something that is more likely to be successful. And so it really, you know, and this is, I think, the guided process, right? And so, and I'll ask you about your own experience in a second, because I think on our own, sometimes we're like, hey, I know this stuff, and, you know, I'm guilty of this myself, and I'm just going to go do this. But when you go through a process and, say, have a coach as part of that that's guiding you through this process, you're going to start doing exercises that you may not typically do, right? But, you know, there's a different dynamic when you're working with other people and maybe a coach and things of that nature. And so now you're more willing to get feedback. And sometimes you don't like the feedback, right? It's like, I have an idea. This is a good idea. And suddenly everyone's like, no, it's not a good idea. You know, you don't necessarily want to hear that.
Which is a fallacy of overconfidence, by the way.
Until you do. And so I'd love to just maybe flip this and ask you about your own experience in terms of, you talked about the one example, but how about in terms of your books, what did you learn? Because you've written 3 books now, so I'm sure that each time you get smarter and smarter in terms of how you approach it.
Yeah, you know, I think when I wrote my first book, there was a clear desire of what we wanted, but it was just not, I think it hit the market flat because it was too much of a stretch of something way far out there that wasn't introduced enough, because we tried to create a whole new way of budgeting. And it was from start to finish, it was too large of a stretch. And what I found with my second 2 books, which are part of a series, Dr. Cole Cash Will See You Now, is I found that the content that I was writing about was more leveraged or geared towards lessons that I learned from talking to people and seeing other advisors, because I was been out on the road talking to advisors then. But I also wanted to make it a little bit unique. Like, I have this like thirst of differentiation. I don't like the status quo. And I think that sometimes hurts me a lot. It's a benefit as well. But what I also found in that process was that I had this big idea that I thought was going to be really interesting. It could be a really kind of longer book. And in reality, when you distill it down to what people care about, it's actually not as much. It you know, it's shorter, simpler, and easier to understand is better than longer, confusing, and just repetitive. And I and when I started going through the process of the concepts of the book, I realized that maybe I didn't have enough for a long book, which then led me to say, I got to be comfortable with like a 65, 70 page book, which actually was better for me for editing purposes because I'm a slow reader. But I was able to then distill it maybe into like shorter chunks of like a series of books. And I think what you get to is that what I learned is I'm not really that interesting. And what I thought was like really big really is actually small, because the real key to writing a successful book, I think, is how do you make the topic that you think is so overwhelming so simple that it can be understood in just a few pages. And you've got to create story around it. I believe that's what I've learned. You've got to create intrigue, and there's got to be a path and like some intrigue level, not just spitting out facts. Yep. You got to make it tied into something else. And that's what we did with Dr. Cole Cash, with creating a new character and making like a business fable from that standpoint. So I don't know if that's really anything, but I think that it's also a matter of, after you're done with the book, I wasn't as good as what you're saying of leveraging it in other ways. I think that is super success, super necessary to be done, and a lesson that I think I failed at that I can get better at. So if you want to go purchase a book, I'll send it to you for free. Just shoot me an email and I'll send you any of the copies of Dr. Cole Cash. I've got so many of them at my house now.
Speaking of which, one of the things is I love print on demand. Is that something that you've taken advantage of, or did you order more?
We did do print on demand. I ordered some for taking the speaking engagements with me, but now I have way too many because, anyhow, that's a whole nother topic. Yeah, but that's some of the lessons I've learned. And I want to ask one other question before, and then we're going to do a lightning round of my closing questions. I mean, Paul, you've been an amazing, you've been so informative, and I've appreciated this conversation, and we're probably going to have you back to talk more about it because we didn't get to everything. But, you know, I'm just curious, you know, I told you about my experience with writing our book. What, I mean, from your side, I think a lot of people, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that not enough time, lack of clarity, imposter syndrome. And I think sometimes people fear that they're not like creative enough to write a book. They don't like have enough knowledge. And that's one of the things I learned, is that I don't have as much knowledge as I thought I had.
Yeah.
And so they fear that. And so maybe in like just a couple of minutes or less, what is the key to making content engaging, right? What makes a book engaging from your perspective?
Yeah. Starts with knowing very clearly who your audience is, who you're writing for, who you're writing this book for, and typically that's described as the avatar. So what's that one perfect reader that you would love to get this book in their hands, and then writing almost as if you're writing to that one person. Second is knowing how that person thinks, their emotion, their thoughts, their concerns, their fears and desires, things that we've already talked about. The next step I find is, and this is part of what we do with the short book formula, is that we have a constraint in that the reality is you might start and think, I don't really know what to write about. I don't know what to say. But once you dive into the process, most people find, wow, I have a lot of experience. I have a lot of stories, I have a lot of stuff. It just needs to be drawn out. But having that constraint's important. So we use 12,000 to 15,000 words typically. And now you actually have to prioritize, okay, what is the content? What are the chapters for this audience? What's the transformation I want to take them on? What's the core problem? What's the solution that ideally ends up leading them to my doorstep? And what are the key things that they want to know? The next thing is that it needs to have stories. It needs to be engaging. It needs to be emotion. You know, it needs to have emotion. People have to connect with it, because people are going to read the book and they're going to forget all the facts and figures, but they're going to remember that story of something that happened. And so, again, I think just the simple version is that you need to know your reader. And when you know your reader, it's that much easier to talk in terms of their interest. I'll give you one quick example of that for myself, which is my latest book. I had two audiences in mind. One was financial advisors and the other was CPAs. And just in straddling that, it's like, well, they react differently. They have different conversations. They have different personalities. And so I ultimately created a little bit of a composite, but, you know, just in that they're both financial professionals, but they're different. And so the more you understand who you're writing to, the more effective your book is going to be.
I think that that's such a great answer. And I just want to highlight two things before we get to that last question. One is, understanding who your perfect reader is and writing to them. I think that that is the lesson that I've learned the most. And when I write my next book, that is going to be the key. And make it as detailed as possible. I always was worried about making it too detailed because I was like, I make it too specific, then it's going to constrain who this book is going to be for. And that's not the reality. It just means that there's going to be a specific set of people that really resonate. It's not going to keep other people from resonating. Nope. It's just that they might not resonate as closely. But you can either try to write to everybody and have nobody resonate, or you can write to one person, have a small group to resonate. That is such a key and important lesson that's so hard to overcome and get to. I love the idea of incorporating a constraint. I actually just wrote a blog about constraints and how important they are. But then the last thing you said about story, and I think that everybody should go out there, if they haven't already, they should read Morgan Housel's books and blogs. Morgan Housel is phenomenal at telling story. He tells story in an effective, engaging way that helps him get his point across. And if you want to learn how to write something that's engaging and is quick reads and uses stories, Morgan Housel is one of the best I've seen, at least in our industry, talking about psychology and everything of that nature. His book, Psychology of Money, and as well, are just really incredible. So that then leads me to my two final questions. Rock, this is kind of lightning round ask, is, and talking about books, I just gave two, but you know, I love learning through reading, and I like to read books. So I always ask people that are much smarter than me what books they're reading, like yourself. And I'm curious, what's one book out there that you think everybody should read or reread if they've already read it? That's not one of your books, because we know that they should go read your books, no question about it. Find them. What's one book out there you think everybody should read?
One of the books that I've read multiple times and recently is called Made to Stick. The authors are Chip and Dan Heath, they're brothers. And this book is all about making your ideas sticky so that, you know, especially as you have likely abstract concepts, how do you really make them stick with your ideal reader, or even just when you're talking and presenting? How do you take that concept and really make an impact and impression upon the person? So that's one that I've read multiple times.
I will second that one. That book has changed my perspective of how I create experiences for team members, for employees, for clients, etc. It's a super book, and they have multiple other books that are really great as well. Last question. What is one actionable take? We talked about a lot. There's a lot we didn't even talk about. Something that maybe you wanted people to talk or hear about. What's one actionable takeaway you hope listeners take from our conversation, or that maybe we didn't have a conversation on, that they can implement tomorrow to make themselves better in any form or facet?
So what comes to my mind, and I'm not sure if this hits it on the head, but I'll answer this way, is that it goes back to when you asked me what's the one line that people should do, which is authority is the priority. And so when you're looking at all of your marketing and everything that you're doing to stand out and essentially decommoditize yourself so that people come to you more so for who you are versus the services and the products that you have, in everything that you do, think about authority/influence, kind of synonyms, if you will. But is this enhancing my authority, or is this just, am I just doing the same thing? Authority is the priority.
I love that. Paul McManus, you're phenomenal. This was such a fun conversation. We could have talked probably for hours and turned this into a Tim Ferriss conversation. But I know that there's people I left a lot out there on the table that people are probably going to want to continue to talk with you about, learn from you on. So what's the best way for people to continue to follow your journey and get in touch with you and potentially work with you?
Nope. Very simple. Go to theshortbookformula.com. And from there, you can get a complimentary copy of my audiobook. And it just takes 60 to 90 minutes to listen to. And if it makes sense to have a conversation, you'll find my calendar information there as well.
Love it. Paul, thank you so much, man. Keep up what you're doing. I appreciate all the effort you're doing to make our industry better. And stay well, be well. And I can't wait to have you back on the podcast here soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.